course," he said, his voice tense and low. "He would be one of them. You would have met him. Dagny, what are they like, these men who... No, don't answer me." In a moment, he added, "So, I've met one of their agents."
"You've met two of them."
His response was a span of total stillness. "Of course," he said dully. "I knew it. I just wouldn't admit to myself that I knew. He was their recruiting agent, wasn't he?"
"One of their earliest and best."
He chuckled. It was a sound of bitterness and longing. "That night, when they got Ken Daniger, I thought that they had not sent anyone after me." The effort by which he made his face grow rigid was almost like the slow, resisted turn of a key locking a sunlit room he could not permit himself to examine. After a while, he said impassively, "Dagny, that new rail we discussed last month, I don't think I'll be able to deliver it. They haven't lifted their regulations off my output. They're still controlling my sales and disposing of my metal as they please. But the bookkeeping is in such a snarl that I'm smuggling a few thousand tons into the black market every week. I think they know it. They're pretending not to. They don't want to antagonize me right now. But you see, I've been shipping every ton I could snatch to some emergency customers of mine. Dagny, I was in Minnesota last month. I've seen what's going on there. The country will starve. Not next year, but this winter. Unless a few of us act, and act fast. There are no grain reserves left anywhere, with Nebraska gone, Oklahoma wrecked, North Dakota abandoned, Kansas barely subsisting. There isn't going to be any wheat this winter, not for the city of New York, nor for any eastern city. Minnesota is our last granary. They've had two bad years in succession, but they have a bumper crop this fall, and they have to be able to harvest it. Have you had a chance to take a look at the condition of the farm equipment industry? They're not big enough, any of them, to keep a staff of efficient gangsters in Washington or to pay percentages to pull peddlers, so they haven't been getting many allocations of materials. Two-thirds of them have shut down, and the rest are about to. And farms are perishing all over the country for lack of tools. You should have seen those farmers in Minnesota. They've been spending more time fixing old tractors that can't be fixed than plowing their fields. I don't know how they managed to survive till last spring. I don't know how they managed to plant their wheat, but they did. They did. There was a look of intensity on his face, as if he were contemplating a rare, forgotten sight, a vision of men. And she knew what motive was still holding him to his job. "Dagny, they had to have tools for their harvest. I've been selling all the metal I could steal out of my own mills to the manufacturers of farm equipment, on credit. They've been sending the equipment to Minnesota as fast as they could put it out. Selling it in the same way, illegally and on credit. But they will be paid this fall, and so will I. Charity hell! We're helping producers. And what tenacious producers. Not lousy, mooching consumers. We're giving loans, not alms. We're supporting ability, not need. I'll be damned if I'll stand by and let those men be destroyed while the pull peddlers grow rich." He was looking at the image of a sight he had seen in Minnesota. The silhouette of an abandoned factory with the light of the sunset streaming unopposed through the holes of its windows and the cracks of its roof, with the remnant of a sign, Ward Harvester Company. "Oh, I know," he said. "We'll save them this winter, but the looters will devour them next year. Still, we'll save them this winter. Well, that's why I won't be able to smuggle any rail for you. Not in the immediate future. And there's nothing left to us but the immediate future. I don't know what is the use of feeding a country if it loses its railroads. But what is the use of railroads where there is no food? What is the use anyway?"
"It's all right, Hank. We'll last with such rail as we have for..."
She stopped. "For a month?"
"For the winter, I hope."
Cutting across their silence, a shrill voice reached them from another table, and they turned to look at a man who had the jittery manner of a cornered gangster about to reach for his gun. "An act of antisocial destruction," he was snarling to a sullen companion, "at a time when there's such a desperate shortage of copper. We can't permit it. We can't permit it to be true." Reardon turned abruptly to look off at the city.
"I'd give anything to know where he is,"
he said, his voice low.
just to know where he is. Right now, at this moment.
What would you do if you knew it?
He dropped his hand in a gesture of futility. I wouldn't approach him. The only homage I can still pay him is not to cry for forgiveness where no forgiveness is possible.
They remained silent. They listened to the voices around them, to the splinters of panic trickling through the luxurious room. She had not been aware that the same presence seemed to be an invisible guest at every table, that the same subject kept breaking through the attempts at any other conversation. People sat in a manner not quite of cringing, but as if they found the room too large and too exposed, a room of glass, blue velvet, aluminum, and gentle lighting. They looked as if they had come to this room at the price of countless evasions, to let it help them pretend that theirs was still a civilized existence. But an act of primeval violence had blasted the nature of their world into the open, and they were no longer able not to see.
How could he? How could he? A woman was demanding with petulant terror. He had no right to do it.
It was an accident, said a young man with a staccato voice and an odor of public payroll. It was a chain of coincidences, as any statistical curve of probabilities can easily prove. It is unpatriotic to spread rumors exaggerating the power of the people's enemies.
Right and wrong is all very well for academic conversations, said a woman with a schoolroom voice and a barroom mouth. But how can anybody take his own ideas seriously enough to destroy a fortune when people need it?
I don't understand it, an old man was saying with quavering bitterness. After centuries of efforts to curb man's innate brutality, after centuries of teaching, training, and indoctrination, with the gentle and the humane.
A woman's bewildered voice rose uncertainly and trailed off.
I thought we were living in an age of brotherhood.
I'm scared, a young girl was repeating. I'm scared. Oh, I don't know. I'm just scared.
He couldn't have done it.
He did.
But why?
I refuse to believe it.
It's not human.
But why?
Just a worthless playboy.
But why?
The muffled scream of a woman across the room, and some half-grasped signal on the edge of Dagny's vision, came simultaneously and made her whirl to look at the city. The calendar was run by a mechanism locked in a room behind the screen, unrolling the same film year after year, projecting the dates in steady rotation, in changeless rhythm, never moving but on the stroke of midnight. The speed of Dagny's turn gave her time to see a phenomenon as unexpected as if a planet had reversed its orbit in the sky. She saw the words, September 2nd, moving upward and vanishing past the edge of the screen. Then, written across the enormous page, stopping time, as a last message to the world and to the world's motor, which was New York, she saw the lines of a sharp, intransigent handwriting. Brother, you asked for it. Francisco Domingo Carlos Andrés Sebastián D'Anconia. She did not know which shock was greater, the sight of the message or the sound of Reardon's laughter. Reardon, standing on his feet in full sight and hearing of the room behind him, laughing above their moans of panic, laughing in greeting and salute and acceptance of the gift he had tried to reject, in release, in triumph, in surrender. On the evening of September 7th, a copper wire broke in Montana, stopping the motor of a loading crane on a spur track of Taggart Transcontinental at the rim of the Stanford Copper Mine. The mine had been working on three shifts, its days and nights blending into a single stretch of struggle to lose no minute, no drop of copper it could squeeze from the shelves of a mountain into the nation's industrial desert. The crane broke down at the task of loading a train. It stopped abruptly and hung still against the evening sky, between a string of empty cars and piles of suddenly immovable ore. The men of the railroad and of the mine stopped in dazed bewilderment. They found that in all the complexity of their equipment, among the drills, the motors, the derricks, the delicate gauges, the ponderous floodlights beating down into the pits and ridges of a mountain, there was no wire to mend the crane. They stopped like men on an ocean liner propelled by 10,000 horsepower generators, but perishing for lack of a safety pin.
The station agent, a young man with a swift body and a brusque voice, stripped the wiring from the station building and set the crane in motion again. And while the ore went clattering to fill the cars, the light of candles came trembling through the dusk from the windows of the station.
"Minnesota, Eddie," said Dagny grimly, closing the drawer of her special file. "Tell the Minnesota division to ship half their stock of wire to Montana."
"But good God, Dagny, with the peak of the harvest rush approaching, they'll hold through it, I think. We don't dare lose a single supplier of copper."
"But I have!" screamed James Taggart when she reminded him once more. "I have obtained for you the top priority on copper wire, the first claim, the uppermost ration level. I've given you all the cards, certificates, documents, and requisitions. What else do you want?"
"The copper wire."
"I've done all I could. Nobody can blame me."
She did not argue. The afternoon newspaper was lying on his desk, and she was staring at an item on the back page. An emergency state tax had been passed in California for the relief of the state's unemployed, in the amount of 50% of any local corporation's gross income ahead of other taxes. The California oil companies had gone out of business.
"Don't worry, Mr. Reardon," said an unctuous voice over a long-distance telephone line from Washington. "I just wanted to assure you that you will not have to worry."
"About what?" asked Reardon, baffled.
"About that temporary bit of confusion in California. We'll straighten it out in no time. It was an act of illegal insurrection. Their state government had no right to impose local taxes detrimental to national taxes. We'll negotiate an equitable arrangement immediately. But in the meantime, if you have been disturbed by any unpatriotic rumors about the California oil companies, I just wanted to tell you that Reardon Steel has been placed in the top category of essential need, with first claim upon any oil available anywhere in the nation. Very top category, Mr. Reardon. So I just wanted you to know that you won't have to worry about the problem of fuel this winter."
Reardon hung up the telephone receiver with a frown of worry. Not about the problem of fuel and the end of the California oil fields. Disasters of this kind had become habitual. But about the fact that the Washington planners found it necessary to placate him. This was new. He wondered what it meant. Through the years of his struggle, he had learned that an apparently causeless antagonism was not hard to deal with. But an apparently causeless solicitude was an ugly danger. The same wonder struck him again when, walking down an alley between the mill structures, he caught sight of a slouching figure whose posture combined an air of insolence with an air of expecting to be swatted. It was his brother, Philip. Ever since he had moved to Philadelphia, Reardon had not visited his former home and had not heard a word from his family, whose bills he went on paying. Then, inexplicably, twice in the last few weeks, he had caught Philip wandering through the mills for no apparent reason. He had been unable to tell whether Philip was sneaking to avoid him or waiting to catch his attention. It had looked like both. He had been unable to discover any clue to Philip's purpose, only some incomprehensible solicitude of a kind Philip had never displayed before. The first time, in answer to his startled, "What are you doing here?" Philip had said vaguely,
"Well, I know that you don't like me to come to your office."
"What do you want?"
"Oh, nothing, but, well, Mother is worried about you."
"Mother can call me any time she wishes." Philip had not answered, but had proceeded to question him in an unconvincingly casual manner about his work, his health, his business. The questions had kept hitting oddly beside the point, not questions about business, but more about his, Reardon's, feelings toward business. Reardon had cut him short and waved him away, but had been left with the small nagging sense of an incident that remained inexplicable. The second time, Philip had said as sole explanation,
"We just want to know how you feel."
"Who's we?"
"Why, Mother and I. These are difficult times, and, well, Mother wants to know how you feel about it all."
"Tell her that I don't." The words had seemed to hit Philip in some peculiar manner, almost as if this were the one answer he dreaded. "Get out of here," Reardon had ordered wearily, "and the next time you want to see me, make an appointment and come to my office. But don't come unless you have something to say. This is not a place where one discusses feelings, mine or anybody else's."
Philip had not called for an appointment. But now there he was again, slouching among the giant shapes of the furnaces, with an air of guilt and snobbishness together, as if he were both snooping and slumming. "But I do have something to say."
"I do,"
he cried hastily in answer to the angry frown on Reardon's face.
"Why didn't you come to my office?"
"You don't want me in your office."
"I don't want you here either."
"But I'm only trying to be considerate and not to take your time when you're so busy. And
you are very busy, aren't you?"
And, well, I just wanted to catch you in a spare moment to talk to you."
"About what?"
I need a job." He said it belligerently and drew back a little. Reardon stood looking at him blankly. "Henry, I want a job. I mean here at the mills. I want you to give me something to do. I need a job. I need to earn my living. I'm tired of alms." He was groping for something to say, his voice both offended and pleading, as if the necessity to justify the plea were an unfair imposition upon him. "I want a livelihood of my own. I'm not asking you for charity. I'm asking you to give me a chance."
"This is a factory, Philip, not a gambling joint."
We
don't take chances or give them."
"I'm asking you to give me a job."
"Why should I?"
"Because I need it."
Reardon pointed to the red spurts of flame shooting from the black shape of a furnace, shooting safely into space 400 feet of steel, clay, and steam-embodied thought above them.
"I need that furnace, Philip. It wasn't my need that gave it to me."
Philip's face assumed a look of not having heard.
"You're not officially supposed to hire anybody, but that's just a technicality. If you'll put me on, my friends will okay it without any trouble, and..."
Something about Reardon's eyes made him stop abruptly, then ask in an angrily impatient voice,
"Well, what's the matter? What have I said that's wrong?"
"What you haven't said."
"I beg your pardon?"
"What you're squirming to leave unmentioned."
"What?"
"That you'd be of no use to me, whatever."
"Is that what you—"
Philip started with automatic righteousness, but stopped and did not finish.
"Yes," said Reardon, smiling. "That's what I think of first."
Philip's eyes oozed away. When he spoke, his voice sounded as if it were darting about at random, picking stray sentences.
"Everybody is entitled to a livelihood. How am I going to get it if nobody gives me my chance? How did I get mine? I wasn't born owning a steel plant. Was I? I can do anything you can. If you'll teach me." "Who taught me?"
"Why do you keep saying that? I'm not talking about you."
"I am."
In a moment, Philip muttered,
"What do you have to worry about? It's not your livelihood that's in question."
Reardon pointed to the figures of men in the steaming rays of the furnace.
"Can you do what they're doing?"
"I don't see what you're—"
"What will happen if I put you there and you ruin a heat of steel for me?"
"What's more important? That your damn steel gets poured, or that I eat?"
"How do you propose to eat if the steel doesn't get poured?"
Philip's face assumed a look of reproach.
"I'm not in a position to argue with you right now, since you hold the upper hand."
"Then don't argue."
Keep
your mouth shut and get out of here."
"But I meant—"
He stopped. Reardon chuckled.
"You meant that it's I who should keep my mouth shut, because I hold the upper hand, and should give in to you because you hold no hand at all?"
"That's a peculiarly crude way of stating a moral principle."
"But that's what your moral principle amounts to, doesn't it?"
"You can't discuss morality in materialistic terms."
"We're discussing a job in a steel plant, and boy, is that a materialistic place."
Philip's body drew a shade tighter together, and his eyes became a shade more glazed, as if in fear of the place around him, in resentment of its sight, in an effort not to concede its reality. He said in the soft, stubborn whine of a voodoo incantation,
"It's a moral imperative, universally conceded in our day and age, that every man is entitled to a job."
His voice rose.
"I'm entitled to it."
"You are?
Go on, then, collect your claim."
Collect your job. Pick it off the bush where you think it grows."
"I mean—"
"You mean that it doesn't?
You mean that you need it but can't create it? You mean that you're entitled to a job which I must create for you?
Yes.
And if I don't? The silence went stretching through second after second.
I don't understand you, said Philip.
His voice had the angry bewilderment of a man who recites the formulas of a well-tested role, but keeps getting the wrong cues in answer.
I don't understand why one can't talk to you anymore. I don't understand what sort of theory you're propounding, and...
Oh, yes, you do. As if refusing to believe that the formulas could fail, Philip burst out with,
Since when did you take to abstract philosophy? You're only a businessman. You're not qualified to deal with questions of principle. You ought to leave it to the experts who have conceded for centuries.
Cut it, Philip. What's the gimmick?
Gimmick?
Why, the sudden ambition.
Well, at a time like this...
Like what?
Well, every man has the right to have some means of support and not be left to be tossed aside. When things are so uncertain, a man's got to have some security, some foothold. I mean, at a time like this, if anything happened to you, I'd have no...
What do you expect to happen to me?
Oh, I don't. I don't.
The cry was oddly, incomprehensibly genuine.
I don't expect anything to happen. Do you?
Such as what?
How do I know? But I've got nothing except the pittance you give me, and you might change your mind any time.
I might.
And I haven't any hold on you at all.
Why did it take you that many years to realize it and start worrying? Why now?
Because you've changed. You
used to have a sense of duty and moral responsibility, but... You're losing it. You're losing it, aren't you?
Reardon stood studying him silently. There was something peculiar in Philip's manner of sliding toward questions, as if his words were accidental, but the too casual, the faintly insistent questions were the key to his purpose.
Well, I'll be glad to take the burden off your shoulders if I'm a burden to you,
Philip snapped suddenly. Just give me a job and your conscience won't have to bother you about me any longer. It doesn't.
That's what I mean. You don't care. You don't care what becomes of any of us, do you?
Of whom?
Why,
mother and me and mankind in general. But I'm not going to appeal to your better self. I know that you're ready to ditch me at a moment's notice, so... You're lying, Philip. That's not what you're worried about. If it were, you'd be angling for a chunk of cash, not for a job, not...
No, I want a job!
The cry was immediate and almost frantic.
Don't try to buy me off with cash. I want a job.
Pull yourself together, you poor louse. Do you hear what you're saying? Philip spit out his answer with impotent hatred.
You can't talk to me that way.
Can you?
I only...
To buy you off? Why should I try to buy you off instead of kicking you out as I should have years ago?
Well, after all, I'm your brother.
What is that supposed to mean?
One's supposed to have some sort of feeling for one's brother.
Do you?
Philip's mouth swelled petulantly. He did not answer. He waited.
Reardon let him wait.
Philip muttered,
You're supposed,
at least,
to have some consideration for my feelings. But you haven't.
Have you, for mine?
Yours? Your feelings?
It was not malice in Philip's voice, but worse. It was a genuine, indignant astonishment.
You haven't any feelings? You've never felt anything at all. You've never suffered.
It was as if a sum of years hit Reardon in the face, by means of a sensation and a sight. The exact sensation of what he had felt in the cab of the first train's engine on the John Galt line. And the sight of Philip's eyes, the pale, half-liquid eyes presenting the uttermost of human degradation, an uncontested pain, and with the obscene insolence of a skeleton toward a living being, demanding that this pain be held as the highest of values. You've never suffered, the eyes were saying to him accusingly, while he was seeing the night in his office when his ore mines were taken away from him, the moment when he had signed the gift certificate surrendering Reardon metal, the month of days inside a plane that searched for the remains of Dagny's body. "You've never suffered," the eyes were saying with self-righteous scorn, while he remembered the sensation of proud chastity with which he had fought through those moments, refusing to surrender to pain, a sensation made of his love, of his loyalty, of his knowledge that joy is the goal of existence, and joy is not to be stumbled upon, but to be achieved. And the act of treason is to let its vision drown in the swamp of the moment's torture. "You've never suffered," the dead stare of the eyes was saying. "You've never felt anything, because only to suffer is to feel. There's no such thing as joy. There's only pain and the absence of pain. Only pain and the zero when one feels nothing. I suffer. I'm twisted by suffering. I'm made of undiluted suffering. That's my purity. That's my virtue. And yours, you, the untwisted one, you, the uncomplaining, yours is to relieve me of my pain. Cut your unsuffering body to patch up mine. Cut your unfeeling soul to stop mine from feeling. And we'll achieve the ultimate ideal, the triumph over life, the zero." He was seeing the nature of those who for centuries had not recoiled from the preachers of annihilation. He was seeing the nature of the enemies he had been fighting all his life. "Philip," he said, "get out of here." His voice was like a ray of sunlight in a morgue. It was the plain, dry, daily voice of a businessman, the sound of health, addressed to an enemy one could not honor by anger, nor even by horror. "And don't ever try to enter these mills again, because there will be orders at every gate to throw you out if you try it." "Well, after all," said Philip, in the angry and cautious tone of a tentative threat, "I could have my friends assign me to a job here, and compel you to accept it." Reardon had started to go, but he stopped and turned to look at his brother. Philip's moment of grasping a sudden revelation was not accomplished by means of thought, but by means of that dark sensation which was his only mode of consciousness. He felt a sensation of terror, squeezing his throat, shivering down into his stomach. He was seeing the spread of the mills with the roving streamers of flame, with the ladles of molten metal sailing through space on delicate cables, with open pits the color of glowing coal, with cranes coming at his head, pounding past, holding tons of steel by the invisible power of magnets. And he knew that he was afraid of this place, afraid to the death, that he dared not move without the protection and guidance of the man before him. Then he looked at the tall, straight figure, standing casually still, the figure with the unflinching eyes whose sight had cut through rock and flame to build this place. And then he knew how easily the man he was proposing to compel could let a single bucket of metal tilt over a second ahead of its time, or let a single crane drop its load a foot short of its goal. And there would be nothing left of him, of Philip, the claimant. And his only protection lay in the fact that his mind would think of such actions, but the mind of Hank Reardon would not. "But we'd better keep it on a friendly basis," said Philip.
"You'd better," said Reardon, and walked away.
Men who worship pain, thought Reardon, staring at the image of the enemies he had never been able to understand. They're men who worship pain. It seemed monstrous, yet peculiarly devoid of importance. He felt nothing. It was like trying to summon emotion toward inanimate objects, toward refuse, sliding down a mountainside to crush him. One could flee from the slide, or build retaining walls against it, or be crushed, but one could not grant any anger, indignation, or moral concern to the senseless motions of the unliving. No, worse, he thought, the anti-living. The same sense of detached concern remained with him while he sat in a Philadelphia courtroom and watched men perform the motions which were to grant him his divorce. He watched them utter mechanical generalities, recite vague phrases of fraudulent evidence, play an intricate game of stretching words to convey no facts and no meaning. He had paid them to do it. He whom the law permitted no other way to gain his freedom, no right to state the facts and plead the truth. The law which delivered his fate, not to objective rules objectively defined, but to the arbitrary mercy of a judge with a wizened face,
and a look of empty cunning.